Chapter 11. The Siege of the City. All the first day of the siege, Rollory's job had been with those who kept the men on the walls and roofs supplied with lances, long, crude, unfinished slivers of holmgrass, weighing a couple of pounds, one end slashed to a long point. Well aimed, one would kill, and even from unskilled hands, a rain of them was a good deterrent to a group of Gaul trying to raise a ladder against the curving landward wall. She had brought bundles of these lances up endless stairs, passed them up as one of a chain of passers on other stairs, run with them through the windy streets, and her hands still bristled with hair-thin, stinging splinters. But now, since daybreak, she had been hauling rocks for the catapults, the rock-throwing things like huge slingshots, which were set up inside the land gate. When the Gaul crowded up to the gate to use their rams, the big rocks, whizzing and whacking down among them, scattered and rescattered them. But to feed the catapults took an awful pile of rocks. Boys kept at work prizing paving stones up from the nearby streets, and her crew of women ran these 8 or 10 at a time on a little round-legged box to the men working the catapults. 8 women pulled together, harnessed to ropes. The heavy box with its dead load of stone would seem immovable, until at last, as they all pulled, its round legs would suddenly turn, and with it clattering and jolting behind, they would pull it uphill to the gate all in one straining rush, dump it, then stand panting a minute and wipe the hair out of their eyes, and drag the bucking empty cart back for more. They had done this all morning. Rocks and ropes had blistered Rollery's hard hands raw. She had torn squares from her thin leather skirt and bound them on her palms with sandal thongs. It helped, and others imitated her.
"I wish you hadn't forgotten how to make air cars," she shouted to Seiko Esmit once as they came clattering down the street at a run with the unwieldy cart jouncing behind them. Seiko did not answer. Perhaps she did not hear. She kept at this grueling work. There seemed to be no soft ones among the Farborns, but the strain they were under told on Seiko. She worked like one in a trance. Once, as they neared the gate, the Gaul began shooting firebrands that fell smoking and smoldering on the stones and the tile roofs. Seiko had struggled in the ropes like a beast in a snare, cowering as the flaming things shot over. "They go out. This city won't burn," Rollory had said softly. But Seiko, turning her unseeing face, had said, "I'm afraid of fire. I'm afraid of fire." But when a young crossbowman up on the wall, struck in the face by a Gaul slingshot, had been thrown backwards off his narrow ledge and crashed down spread-eagled beside them, knocking over 2 of the harnessed women and spattering their skirts with his blood and brains, it had been Seiko that went to him and took that smashed head on her knees, whispering goodbye to the dead man. "That was your kinsman?" Rollory asked, as Seiko resumed her harness and they went on. The Alteran woman said, "We are all kinsmen in the city. He was John Kendi Lee, the youngest of the council, a young wrestler in the arena in the great square, shining with sweat and triumph, telling her to walk where she liked in his city. He was the first Farborn that had spoken to her." She had not seen Jacob Agat since the night before last, for each person left in Landin, human and Farborn, had his job and place, and Agat's was everywhere, holding a city of 1,500 against a force of 15,000. As the day wore on and weariness and hunger lowered her strength, she began to see him too sprawled out on bloody stones down at the other main attack point, the sea gate above the cliffs. Her crew stopped work to eat bread and dried fruit brought by a cheerful lad hauling a round-legged cart of provisions, a serious little maiden lugging a skin of water
gave them to drink. Rollory took heart. She was certain that they would all die, for she had seen from the rooftops the enemy blackening the hills. There was no end to them. They had hardly begun the siege yet. She was equally certain that Agat could not be killed, and that since he would live, she would live. What had death to do with him? He was life, her life. She sat on the cobbled street, comfortably chewing hard bread. Mutilation, rape, torture, and horror encompassed her within a stone's throw on all sides. But there she sat, chewing her bread. So long as they fought back with all their strength, with all their heart, as they were doing, they were safe at least from fear. But not long after came a very bad time. As they dragged their lumbering load towards the gate, the sound of the clattering cart and all sounds were drowned out by an incredible howling noise outside the gate, a roar like that of an earthquake, so deep and loud as to be felt in the bone, not heard. And the gate leaped on its iron hinges, shuddering. She saw Agat then for a moment. He was running, leading a big group of archers and dart-gunners up from the lower part of town, yelling orders to another group on the walls as he ran. All the women scattered, ordered to take refuge in streets near the center of town. "Ho! Ho! Ho!" went the crowd voice at the land gate, a noise so huge it seemed the hills themselves were making it, and would rise and shake the city off the cliffs into the sea. The wind was bitter cold. Her crew was scattered. All was confusion. She had no work to lay her hand to. It was getting dark. The day was not that old. It was not time yet for darkness. All at once, she saw that she was in fact going to die, believed in her death. She stood still and cried out under her breath, there in the empty street between the high, empty houses. On a side street, a few boys were prizing up stones and carrying them down to build up the barricades that had been built across the four streets that led into the main square, reinforcing the gates. She joined them to keep warm, to keep doing something. They labored in silence, five or six of them, doing work too heavy for them. "Snow," one of them said, pausing near her. She looked up from the stone she was pushing foot by foot down the street, and saw the white flakes whirling before her, falling thicker every moment. They all stood still. Now there was no wind, and the monstrous voice howling at the gate fell silent. Snow and darkness came together, bringing silence. "Look at it," a boy's voice said in wonder. Already they could not see the end of the street. A feeble yellowish glimmer was the light from the League Hall, only a block away. "We've got all winter to look at the stuff," said another lad, "if we live that long. Come on, they must be passing out supper at the hall." "You coming?" the youngest one said to Rollory. "My people are in the other house, theater, I think." "No, we're all eating in the hall to save work. Come on." The boys were shy, gruff, comradely. She went with them. The night had come early. The day came late. She woke in Agat's house beside him and saw the gray light on the gray walls, slits of dimness leaking through the shutters that hid the glass windows. Everything was still, entirely still. Inside the house and outside it, there was no noise at all. How could a besieged city be so silent? But siege and Gauls seemed very far off, kept away by this strange daybreak hush. Here there was warmth, and Agat beside her lost in sleep. She lay very still. Knocking downstairs, hammering at the door, voices. The charm broke. The best moment passed. They were calling Agat. She roused him, a hard job. At last, still blind with sleep, he got himself on his feet and opened window and shutter, letting in the light of day. The third day of siege, the first of storm. Snow lay a foot deep in the streets and was still falling, ceaseless, sometimes thick and calm, mostly driving on a hard north wind. Everything was silenced and transformed by snow. Hills, forest, fields, all were gone. There was no sky. The near rooftops faded off into white. There was fallen snow and falling snow for a little ways, and then you could not see it all. Westward, the tide drew back and back into the silent storm. The causeway curved out into void. The stack could not be seen. No sky, no sea. Snow drove down over the dark cliffs, hiding the sands. Agat latched shutter and window and turned to her. His face was still relaxed with sleep. His voice was hoarse. "They can't have gone," he muttered, for that was what they had been calling up to him from the street. "The Gaul have gone! They've pulled out! They're running south!" There was no telling. From the walls of Landin nothing could be seen but the storm. But a little way farther into the storm there might be 1,000 tents set up to weather it out, or there might be none. A few scouts went over the walls on ropes. 3 returned, saying they had gone up the ridge to the forest and found no Gaul. But they had come back, because they could not even see the city itself from 100 yards off. One never came back, captured or lost in the storm. The Alterans met in the library of the hall. As was customary, any citizen who wished came to hear and deliberate with them. The council of the Alterans was 8 now, not 10. John Kendi Lee was dead, and so was Harris, the youngest and the oldest. There were only 7 present, for Pilotson was on guard duty. But the room was crowded with silent listeners. "They are not gone. They are not close to the city. Some are... Ala Pasphal spoke thickly. The pulse throbbed in her neck. Her face was muddy gray. She was best trained of all the Farborns at what they called mind-hearing. She could hear men's thoughts farther than any other, and could listen to a mind that did not know she heard it. "That is forbidden," Agat had said long ago, a week ago, and he had spoken against this attempt to find out if the Gaul were still encamped near Landin. "We've never broken that law," he said, "never in all the exile." And he said, "We'll know where the Gaul are as soon as the snow lets up. Meanwhile, we'll keep watch." But others did not agree with him, and they overrode his will. Rollery was confused and distressed when she saw him withdraw, accepting their choice. He had tried to explain to her why he must. He said he was not the chief of the city or the council, that 10 Alterans were chosen and ruled together. But it all made no sense to Rollery. Either he was their leader or he was not. And if he was not, they were lost. Now the old woman writhed, her eyes unseeing, and tried to speak in words her unspeakable half-glimpses into alien minds whose thoughts were in an alien speech, her brief, inarticulate grasp of what another being's hands touched. I hold, line, rope, she stammered. Rollery shivered in fear and distaste. Agat sat turned from Allah, withdrawn. At last Allah was still, and sat for a long time with bowed head. Saiko Esmit poured out for each of the 7 Alterans and Rollery the tiny ceremonial cup of tea. Each, barely touching it with his lips, passed it on to a fellow citizen, and he to another, till it was empty. Rollery looked fascinated at the bowl Agat gave to her before she drank and passed it on. Blue, leaf-frail, It let the light pass through it like a jewel.
"The Gaul have gone," Alla Pasphal said aloud, raising her ravaged face. "They are on the move now, in some valley between two ranges. That came very clear."
"Giln Valley," one of the men murmured.
"About 10 kilos south from the bogs."
"They are fleeing from the winter. The walls of the city are safe."
"But the law is broken," Agat said, his hoarsened voice cutting across the murmur of hope and jubilation. "Walls can be mended. Well, we'll see."
Rollery went with him down the staircase and through the vast assembly room, crowded now with trestles and tables, for the communal dining hall was there under the golden clocks and the crystal patterns of planets circling their suns.
"Let's go home," he said, and pulling on the big hooded fur coats that had been issued to everyone from the storerooms underneath the old hall, they went out together into the blinding wind in the square. They had not gone 10 steps when out of the blizzard a grotesque figure plastered with red-streaked white burst on them, shouting, "The Sea Gate! They're inside the walls at the Sea Gate!"
Agat glanced once at Rollery and was gone into the storm. In a moment, the clangor of metal on metal broke out from the tower overhead, booming, snow-muffled. They called that great noise the Bell, and before the siege began, all had learned its signals. 4, 5 strokes, then silence, then 5 again, and again. "All men to the Sea Gate! The Sea Gate!" Rollery dragged the messenger out of the way, under the arcades of the League Hall, before men came bursting from the doors, coatless or struggling into their coats as they ran, armed and unarmed, pelting into the whirling snow, vanishing in it before they were across the square. No more came. She could hear some noise in the direction of the Sea Gate, seeming very remote through the sound of the wind and the hushing of the snow. The messenger leaned on her in the shelter of the arcade. He was bleeding from a deep wound in his neck, and would have fallen if she had let him. She recognized his face. He was the Alteran called Pilotson, and she used his name to rouse him and keep him going as she tried to get him inside the building. He staggered with weakness and muttered as if still trying to deliver his message, "They broke in. They're inside the walls."